Welcome to Matriarchal Medicine, a sanctuary designed to inspire women on their journey to matriarchy by reconnecting them with their intuition and innate wisdom. Join us as we explore the stories, wisdom, and medicine of women who are claiming this sacred and holy role. In each episode, we'll uncover transformative insights and practical tools to help you create the life you desire. Through inspiring interviews and meaningful conversations, Matriarchal Medicine invites you to step into your innate leadership potential and create a legacy of love, wisdom, and resilience. Hello, I'm your host, Audrey Thorpe, and in this episode, I'm going to start a small mini-series of informed consent. This particular topic is incredibly near and dear to my heart as an autonomous birth keeper, as a holistic physiologic practitioner. It's something that I absolutely go into deep, in-depth conversation with the clients that I work with the mothers that I work with the families that I work with. We absolutely go through informed consent in all aspects of my practice and in life in general. Now, to put things into perspective, informed consent is something that you, the individual, gives to a practitioner that you're working with. A lot of people hear informed consent and they think that this is something that a practitioner gives to you. It's actually the opposite. When we're consenting to something, we are accepting the terms and conditions that, you know, go along with it. And I think all of us can, in some degree, all of us can absolutely raise our hand when we say that I have clicked the terms and conditions without even reading the 13 pages of the terms and conditions. And that's fine. That's great. We gave consent. And in all reality, we had the opportunity to give informed consent. We had every opportunity to read through the terms and conditions. But most of us, myself included, typically don't with online things, which that's a whole bag of worms in itself. But my point is, we have the opportunity to provide informed consent in those situations. Whether or not you read it all or not, that's totally up to you. But with medical and healthcare decisions, this is where this is a topic that needs to be addressed more. So this is an important topic, whether or not you're choosing to, you know, receive quote unquote care from the system, you know, navigating it inside the system or outside of the system. In both instances, it's something that needs to be discussed in great depth and detail. Now, the big difference with working inside the system and out of the system is, I should just speak for how I conduct myself. When I have a prenatal session with a mom and her family, I'm with them for about 2 hours. And the reason why I spend that much time and I invest that much time into the families that I work with is because I'm really trying to establish a deep, deep, nourishing relationship with this woman. I you know, travel with her throughout her pregnancy and then hold space for her during her birth and immediately postpartum, which are all very delicate and open stages of her life. So I don't want to be a stranger showing up when she's going through the portal that is birth. Now, women that I talk to, I should say for the majority, obviously there are some exceptions to this, but for the majority, they lament that, you know, they spend more time in the waiting room than they do actually at their appointment. So you have about, you know, a very, very small limited time to pee in a cup, to take your little test, to do the little blood work, to check your, you know, if that's relevant for that appointment, to check your blood pressure, check your heart rate. Okay, great. Any questions? Nope. Great. See you in a couple weeks. So you have to go in there with your questions. You have to go in there with, you know, your list of things that comes up, because otherwise so many women will default to fawn state or a freeze state and just, you know, be the good little girl and, you know, yes sir, yes ma'am, white coat syndrome, you know, all the things. Which is why, again, having informed consent is so important for those of us who default to the fawn or freeze stress response. So this particular episode is going to be very, very, very niched. I realize this is already a very niche podcast, a very niche topic to begin with. So the reason why this is so niche is because Rogam is a biomed that is only used for Rh negative women in their pregnancy, where they are carrying a baby that could potentially have Rh positive blood. So this can look like you have a partner, like in my instance, I'm A negative and my husband has a positive blood type. So because of that, there's a possibility that our babies have a positive blood type, that if for whatever reason our blood was to mix, whether that be through a, you know, say car accident or a fall, a pregnancy loss, an ectopic pregnancy, basically this biomed, this injectable would essentially kind of trick my immune system into thinking that there's no threat of the Rh positive blood that's in my body, with the potential of the blood being mixed. And I know that's probably not like a great explanation of it, but what I wanted to get into with this particular episode is Rogam has been sold and promoted to the pregnant women since the 1960s. So we're looking at potentially, I think Rogam's website says like 5 generations, which is insane to think, like 5 generations have already passed since the 60s. But Rogam's website specifically quotes that they've been saving babies since, you know, the 60s. And where I want to get into the informed consent piece with this is so many Rh negative women they aren't given the opportunity to provide true informed consent. And the reason why I say that is I personally have received Rogam at the very least 2 times during my pregnancies. I've had 3 pregnancies and I have 2 living babies. And those 2 times that I say at least 2, I have no recollection if I did or did not receive it postpartum after my first baby. Typically it is given postpartum if you give birth to a baby who has a positive blood type. And I still don't know. I still don't recall my daughter's blood type. So I don't know if I did or didn't receive. I can't find my paperwork to say if I did or didn't. So that's why I'm saying at least 2 times I received it prenatally. So in those 2 instances, I was not informed of the benefits or the potential risks. So with that, I did not provide informed consent. In both instances that I received Rogam, it was presented to me as this is something to help your future, or this is something to help you have healthy babies. And that was about it. Now the conversation around informed consent has 2 really huge facets. In my opinion, the weight of information and the weight of truly educating the clients that you work with, the patients that you work with, that should fall and default to the practitioner that you're working with. Because if you are trained up, if you are knowledgeable, if you have this wisdom of what you're working with, you are the quote unquote authority on this topic. If a client or a patient comes to you, you have more information on this. That's why they're choosing to work with you than the client or the patient does. Now, that said, we as consumers also have a huge weight of responsibility as well to not just blindly take their suggestions, to not just blindly take It's very, very telling when we only discuss the benefits of receiving something. It's very telling when we only hear like, oh, this is why we're doing it. This is what it can help with, this is what it can save you from, or whatever terminology you want to use. So that said, I absolutely own the fact that I did not research, I did not study, I didn't look into anything Rogam related for my first two pregnancies. Now, I also say that through a very interesting lens because I researched and studied, I think I've talked about this in previous episodes, I was researched and studied up on everything pregnancy and birth related. I went into my first pregnancy knowing I wanted an out-of-hospital birth. I knew that I wanted no ultrasounds. I knew I wanted no Doppler. I wasn't going to do any flu shots or no injectables at any point during my pregnancy. And I say this because I didn't even know my own blood type going into my pregnancy in the first place. So at my first initial prenatal appointment that I had, where I had my blood drawn, they obviously knew my blood type. We didn't really talk about anything, blood type related, other than I will say they did encourage my husband to go find out his blood type. So he went and donated blood, found out his blood type, and that's when we realized that he had a positive blood type and I had a negative blood type. And that was the extent of the conversation, just that. They didn't, suggest or, recommend that I start looking into anything like, researching Rogam or anything like that. And this is, again, pretty early into my pregnancy. And close to my 28-week appointment, I don't remember where I was, between 26 and 28 weeks, I don't remember which one it was. I had an appointment, and at the end of that appointment, it was okay, and we're gonna go ahead and do the Rogam shot today. And I, immediately was like, no, we're not doing any shots. Like, that's not, I'm, what is this? And that was my first introduction to Rogam, was that very appointment right there. And the way the midwife kind of, flippantly described it was, oh, it's just, to help you have healthy babies in the future. And that was it. And again, this is where I go back to the fawn and freeze response. And I just, well, okay, and dropped my pants and got, according to my husband, it was a huge freaking needle. But I got a big ol' shot in the butt, and that was that. That was the extent of my conversation over what Rogam was. And this is where, again, I go back to there was no opportunity for true informed consent in that conversation. And what I mean by true informed consent is Rh negative mothers are told that this is a life-saving drug. It's helped, numerous amounts of babies, being saved and all of this, from the 1960s and all of that, because if the mother's antibodies are high, then it'll basically attack the baby in utero. Now, the reason why I keep mentioning that this was prominent and came out in the 60s is for a very important piece, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But the reason why I wanted to put things into perspective is because that was my conversation around Rogam with a midwife outside of the hospital setting. I blindly trusted that because I was birthing outside of the hospital, that, oh, the midwives wouldn't suggest anything, because we're very aligned, because we're very this, we're very that. And I quickly realized, oh, no, we're not. Like, at my birth, I realized, oh, no, we're not. We're not. This is not what I signed up for. This is not what I wanted. Anyway, another story for another time. But my point is, if this was the type of conversation I was having where my prenatal appointments were, I think about an hour long, which was great. It was, very, as personable as you can get in that short amount of time. It was still in a birth center setting. It wasn't the comfort of my home, but regardless, I know it was nothing compared to a typical OB's office, is what I'm trying to say. So I can only imagine the type of conversations that happen with Rh negative mothers in an OB's office. So the reason why I want to have this conversation, and here we are like this deep in the conversation already, but the reason why I want to have this conversation is because we spend so much time and energy on the gender reveals, and we spend so much time and energy on the baby showers and the nursery designs and like the latest car seats and all the baby gadgets and trying to get them in daycare before they're even born. And we, myself included in this conversation, didn't do our due diligence before we accepted a bio-injectable into our body while we're carrying a baby. So in the case of Rogam, in my instance, I really started researching a lot of it in the past probably 2 years. And bless Sarah Wickham for her work. She is a midwife. I believe she's based out of the UK. I will post links to the two books that I praise for so much wisdom, so much knowledge on the topic of Rogam. It's called Rogam in the United States, and I believe like all of North America. And it's essentially called Anti-D in other countries. I will link those books in the show notes below for any Rh negative mother with a Rh positive father for the baby. So you can do your due diligence so you can provide true informed consent. Or when you go to decline Rogam, you are doing so with, again, full, you're doing it from an informed place. So the reason why I keep referencing that this was a heroic wonder drug that came out in the 1960s, I really want to set the stage for what the birth scene looked like during this time. So I believe it was in the 1930s that pretty much 95% of all of the births had moved out of the home and into the hospital. And this was thanks to a very successful propaganda war, I guess, on the lay healers, on the granny midwives, on the grand midwives, the lay women who were attending physiologic births or who were attending births in the home. So the propaganda that they promoted was that the hospital was safer. And the hospital, they were more qualified to attend births than the midwives were. The doctors realized, or I should say, the powers that be that make the money off of the hospitals, that own the hospitals, realized that birth was an untapped market. And that's when the propaganda started. And that's where we saw this huge shift in home births switching to, again, 95% of them being hospital births going forward at that point. So the really important thing to realize with all of this is birth went from a physiologic event to a highly managed, highly manipulated, and high intervention event. One of the beautiful things that I love about wise midwives and wise women is they tend to sit on their hands and just let everything unfold how nature intended. They're not in there poking and prodding. They're not in there, with their hands inside women, doing cervical checks throughout labor. Like, that's so counterintuitive to how our physiology works. With hospital births being the popular option at this point, it turned to the complete opposite. So this is where it's really, again, the time is very important to note because this is also during the time of the twilight sleep. This is also during the time of highly medicalized interventions where, you know, knock them out, drag them out type births were happening. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with the twilight sleep, this is essentially where they would fully drug up these mothers, and they would tie them down to their beds so they weren't harm to themselves or harm to others because of all the major hallucinations that they would experience. And they would essentially just very aggressively get the baby out. Now, the whole argument with why Rogam is so important is because there's a potential for the fetal blood and the mother's blood to mix during a traumatic event. So if you put this into perspective of, oh, these births that they're experiencing in the hospitals are incredibly traumatic. They are, and I mean that on so many levels, but incredibly traumatic to the placenta, incredibly traumatic to the baby, to the mother. It's a perfect opportunity for the blood to mix. So during this time, families were also much larger than they typically are now. So we have some Rh negative mothers who are giving birth to their fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh baby. These babies were coming out incredibly anemic and had a real difficulty thriving. And they attribute it back to, well, it's an Rh negative mother with Rh positive babies. And the mother, essentially, her immune system attacked the baby in utero. So how can we fix these mothers whose bodies are breaking, these mothers' bodies are failing them in birth, and they're attacking their babies? Because there was a trauma that happened in the first place. So instead of, hey, let's look at how we've come in and completely interfered with our with mother's physiology and our mother's giving birth, let's just find a drug that we can, which keep in mind, Rogam only works if you have never been sensitized before. So at this point, these babies weren't even being saved because the damage had already been done. So the reason why this is so important to note is because if there is a mixing of the blood, which again, our physiology is designed so there is no mixing of the blood, but if there was due to trauma, what happens is the Rh negative mother's blood and her immune system turns online, and it's like, oh, there's a foreign protein in our body, which is the Rh positive protein. And it views it as an invader, it views it as an intruder and something that needs to be fought off. Once that mother's system is sensitized, and the reason why this is worth noting is because with every pregnancy with a Rh positive baby, again, Rh positive baby, the immune system of the mother raises the antibody level even higher than the previous pregnancy. So again, if we go back to the 60s, when women were having more and more and more babies than what we typically do, that's why it would typically only affect the baby like number 4, number 5, number 6, is because at that point in the woman's life, her body had already been sensitized and already knew, like, oh, hey, we need to up our antibody count even more for this next invasion that the body perceives as a threat. So Rogam is not relevant for women who have already been sensitized. And I think this is also like the part that nobody discusses is a woman could already be sensitized and her not know it because, oh, she slipped and fell and there was a little bit of spotting, there was a little bit of bleeding. So again, these are things that aren't discussed is when we talk about Rogam. It's not discussed as a matter of, you know, how many babies do you see yourself having? Most women today, most, again, I know there's a lot of families who are very, very bountiful and blessed with multiple babies, but most families right now in the nuclear family setup, especially within the United States, it's like 1 to 3 babies. And that's usually where we start, capping off how many babies we're having. Again, I'm pulling out like just very basic round numbers, but my point is we're not having the same amount of babies that we were having back in the 60s. And again, the other thing that we have to consider with this conversation also is how are your babies being born? Are you dealing with forced pushing? Are you dealing with coached pushing? Because that right there will attribute to potential mixing of the blood. Ultrasounds have even been attributed to potentially a risk factor of blood mixing between the baby and the mother. Sarah Wickman again goes into like fluoride in our water and, the depletion of nutrients from our soil, like so many differentiating factors between where we are today and where we were back in the 30s. So this is what I'm saying is these are the conversations that need to be happening before we're consenting to these bio drugs in the first place. Why does this drug exist in the first place? Well, it exists because doctors who had no business attending births were causing the very problem that this bio drug was designed to fix. Babies being ripped and dragged out of their mothers, causing trauma to the placenta, causing trauma to the perineum, causing trauma to the uterus in general, that absolutely attributes to the blood mixing. So the other thing that is also not included in conversations, and had I known this information, I absolutely would not have received it. It is made from blood. It is made from multiple blood donations from multiple different people, and it is essentially pooled. So again, there's no way to distinguish between what's getting added, what's not getting added, who's, it's a whole thing. And again, back to like Rogam's exact website, which again, I never saw an insert on Rogam before I, consented, quote unquote, to receive Rogam. It discloses that this blood has been screened to the best of their ability against known pathogens. Now, what I want to bring to the conversation is you can't screen for unknown pathogens. You can't screen for a lot of things that we don't know about yet. So you're injecting, I received two injections of a biomed made from hundreds of thousands of people's blood into my body, and you can't tell me that that does not affect my DNA. And that does not affect my baby's DNA. So one of the biggest criticisms for Rogam is that there have been no long-term studies done, despite the fact that this has been around since the 60s. So we're talking 60 years that this has been on the market, and there's been no long-term studies to see the effects that Rogam has. Because another big thing to consider, and this is the part that I have to give myself grace on, is what are the consequences of a Rh negative mother carrying an Rh negative daughter? Again, I still don't know my daughter's blood type, but what are the consequences of me receiving this injection and it going into my bloodstream, which it's proven that 10% of the Rogam injection actually does cross the placenta to the baby. What is the potential side effects? What is the damage? What is the benefits, which I personally have yet to find any. But what are the yeah, what is the consequence of my potentially Rh negative female baby in utero receiving 10% of Rogam during her literally developmental stages? Is that going to have an effect on her fertility in the future? Is that going to have an effect on her so many different things. The Rogam in the past had high levels of preservatives in it. I'm not for sure. I don't remember if it was mercury or thermocell or something along those lines, but had high levels of preservatives in it as well. Again, you want to tell me that there's no consequences for that being. So the other things that also aren't discussed during these conversations about Rogam is there has been HIV that has been transmitted through the Rogam injection, and there's been hepatitis C that has been transmitted through Rogam to a large number of women, to a large population of women. So this wasn't like a fluke. This wasn't like, oh, one or two got it, and yeah, we were able to trace it back to Rogam. I'm talking about thousands of women that had been injected with tainted, tainted blood material that absolutely gave them HIV and absolutely gave them hepatitis C. These are conversations that are not happening when we're talking about Rogam during our prenatal visits. Again, if I was told these conversations, there's no way that I would have had these injections given to me. There's no way I would have consented to those. So this is again just one example of how we make a problem, and then instead of adjusting the problem, we come up with the band-aid for it. We're not getting to the root cause of why is the blood mixing. We're not getting to the root cause of, oh, how about we actually let the third stage of labor play out? We're not, talking about placentas that are being literally ripped out and pulled out of mothers' uteruses because the OB has other things to do. And, oh, it's no big deal. Just pump them full of Pitocin and they'll be good because we're managing a postpartum hemorrhage that we caused because we pulled out the placenta instead of letting it detach as it's designed to. So, but it's fine. We'll just give her Rogam and we'll just give her Pitocin and we'll be fine. Instead of, oh, hey, let's just be patient and allow everything to unfold as it's supposed to, as it's designed to. But because it's so difficult and it's a very intensive test to do to find your babies, it's also a, relatively dangerous test to do during, in utero to find the baby's blood type. It's just easier to just do it as, routine care, routine, something that we just do routinely. And there's a quote that Sarah Wickman has in her book, and I'm totally going to butcher it. But essentially she's quoting one of the midwives that she interviewed for her book. And it essentially goes like, there is no room for routine when you're talking to someone who truly honors the sacredness of birth. There's no room for routine in those conversations. And it's kind of what I go back to, the conversation that I had with a mom who got so upset with me because I couldn't tell her what my protocol was if something, if this happened or if that happened. There's no room for routine. Just allow physiology to unfold and allow this sacred and holy event to unfold, and then address as the mother sees fit. As I mentioned, this episode is the first of a mini series on informed consent. This episode included Rogam, and the next two episodes that I have planned for this mini series is the heated conversation around circumcision, as well as vitamin K. All of these are typically routine practices, and most of the time we do not provide informed consent to those practitioners that are carrying out these routine procedures. If you enjoyed any of my episodes thus far, my podcast, Matriarchal Medicine, if you've enjoyed any of these episodes, if you enjoy matriarchal medicine, please be sure to hit that follow button to make sure that you stay up to date with all of the future episodes, as well as if you feel called, leave a review so others know what to expect. We can spread this message far and wide on the true medicine that comes from stepping into our power, our own autonomy, and our true matriarchal medicine. That is all for this episode. So until next time, I pray that you are deeply, deeply nourished on your journey to matriarchy.